Welcome back to In the Hive. I'm Roger McDonough. There is an impasse in Washington over what the next round of coronavirus relief will look like. Congressional negotiations have stalled, hinging on a couple of snags over unemployment benefits and aid to state and local governments. Republican Senator Mitt Romney joined me via the phone on Wednesday morning to talk about that stalemate, about mail-in voting during a pandemic, about the November presidential election, and more. Senator Mitt Romney, thank you very much for joining me today.
Good to be with you, Roger.
Let's start with something that so many Americans are looking to Congress to do, which is to re-up federal relief in the midst of the pandemic. A first round of stimulus was passed back in March. It was $2.2 trillion, and you voted for that. Leaving aside the president's actions this weekend for now, which in any case don't do anything close to what Congress did back in March, leaving that just to the side to begin with, do you agree that roughly the same amount of stimulus as was passed before, meaning as was passed back in March, is needed again to prop up the American economy, Senator Romney?
No, I think a number probably less than half that is appropriate. I think we need to provide additional unemployment benefits for individuals. I think we also need to update the loan program to small businesses. It's actually a grant program to very small businesses. Right. Those are two areas that I think are critical, and would like to see us move on those right away, in addition to funding for additional testing for vaccine manufacture. But these things coming together provide, I think, the support that the economy and our families desperately need.
The context here is 5.1 million coronavirus infections in the United States, 165,000 deaths, a lot of people out of work, 10% unemployment. My understanding is that one of the sticking points in these negotiations, if not the sticking point, is renewing the additional $600 unemployment benefit. That's the extra $600 that people who are unemployed because of this pandemic were receiving. That has expired. I know you have a proposal on this to address various concerns, but why not just renew that $600 benefit exactly as it is?
Well, first of all, as you know, the state provides about $350 a week to someone that's unemployed, and right. The $600 was a supplement above that. So an unemployed individual was making $950 a week. We found that nationwide, about 68% of the people who were receiving that benefit were being paid more for not working than they were being paid previously for working. And that created a disincentive for individuals to go back to work, particularly at a time when going back to work meant potential exposure to COVID-19. So the thought was, we want to get the number to a level that makes it such that people are not being paid more to stay home than they're being paid to work, because we want to get people back to work and get the economy under the way again.
That fear that this benefit incentivizes people, you know, to not return to work, what occurs to me when I hear that is that in many instances, from a public health standpoint, people going back to work in a lot of industries might not actually be safe. And so, you know, that being the case for those workers who can't go back safely, this added benefit might allow them to pay their rent, buy their medication, and so on. Can you talk about how you view that particular challenge of our reality, Senator Romney, the fact that for some people, going back to work, it might not be an option?
That's absolutely right. And therefore, an unemployment benefit, a supplement, if you will, to the state level, such that people are being paid as much as they were being paid when they're working, will certainly allow them to keep meeting their obligations for their rent and food and health care and so forth. But it's hard to explain why people should be paid more for staying at home than they were being paid while they were working.
Okay, well, just on the negotiations, for a time, the Republican leadership was looking at lowering the payment, you know, this added unemployment benefit to $200. Democrats didn't like that. Leader McConnell said maybe $400 was doable. And then last week, you and two Republican Senate colleagues, Susan Collins and Martha McSally, you proposed a kind of compromise on uninsurance, $500 in August, and then a gradual decrease of that benefit. Do I have that right?
Yes, that's right. Decrease until state systems were able to put in place a simple provision, which is to say that people would be paid effectively what they were paid in after-tax dollars prior to being unemployed. So the challenge that our state systems have is that they can't calculate very easily what the right payment is. So we wanted to give them a couple of months to be able to do that. That was the $500 a month, $500 a week that we were proposing for the first month, and $400 a week for the next month. And then at that stage, shift over to a plan that's based upon what people were previously being paid. We said 80% of what they were previously being paid while they were working, but because it's tax-free, that basically grosses up to the same amount that they had while they were working.
What do you think of the president's plan? I mean, he this past weekend bypassed Congress to take his own action, three memoranda and one executive order. He basically had a $400 additional unemployment benefit, and that's down from the $600, again, that we were talking about before. But what it does is it requires states to pay a quarter of that, and it's unclear if, you know, many states can actually do that. Is that something that is workable? It seems like it creates a new system for applying for unemployment, too.
The good news on that is that the White House just today announced that the states do not have to come up with an additional $100. They will get credit for their unemployment program they already have in place. The federal government will therefore be providing $300 per week per unemployed individual as soon as the states say they want to participate in that program. So in my own view, every state in America should grab that money as quickly as they can, and at the same time should encourage their elected officials to try and do a deal that's a better deal. But it's a stopgap program that will help people that are hurting right now because the unemployment supplement ended several days ago, and the president wants to get people this unemployment funding as quickly as possible on a bridge basis, at least while we're waiting for a final deal to be negotiated.
Okay, so and I guess that is your proposal more of a final deal proposal and the president's is a stopgap?
Mine was designed to be a stopgap as well until a final deal is proposed. We'll see where we get. We're negotiating a lot of different numbers,
right.
But the proposal I put out there was one. There are several that are out there. All of them are designed to get additional funding to people that are unemployed and to have that in place until the high level of unemployment in our country is finally reduced.
Senator, I'm trying to manage our time appropriately here, and so just so we don't run out of time before we do address it, I want to jump to a topic that I'm hoping we can tackle, which is mail-in voting. Because of the pandemic, more Americans will be voting by mail than ever have done before. For some time, though, the president, President Donald Trump, has been sowing distrust in mail-in voting, making false claims about widespread voter fraud, and there have been countless fact checks on that. And it turns out that there's very little voter fraud at all in this country by mail or otherwise. But while Utah has had by-mail voting for a number of years, a lot of places have not had it. And I'm wondering, from your perspective, will the country be ready for this election in November?
Well, I certainly hope so. And I don't believe there's any reason for disparaging our voting system or creating a lack of confidence in the credibility of our electoral system. Each state puts in place their own program for gathering votes. I would hope that each state could learn, those states that don't have the experience that Utah has, they could learn from Utah and other states that have been voting by mail for some time, and would have backup systems, would obviously have a paper copy of ballots in place, such that if there were an audit necessary, that one could determine whether there had been any voter fraud. I hope people recognize that voter fraud is a felony and is a very serious infraction of the law, and I can't imagine people wanting to participate in that. We have a hard time getting people to vote once, let alone voting multiple times.
Yeah.
So, I believe in a vote-by-mail system. Will there be complications? Of course, I'm sure there always will be. But the nice thing about having paper ballots is you can always go back and look at the original ballot, look at the signature that's there, and make sure there has not been voter fraud of some kind.
There have been proposals in Congress, I think mainly from Democrats, to put a lot of money into ensuring that states are ready to vote by mail, meaning money for local elections offices. Is that something that you support and see a need for?
I think you will see in the final bill that's done with regards to COVID relief that there will be some additional funding that goes to states. How much goes to states is uncertain at this point. The federal government does not want to take over the responsibility for votes and the voting process. That is something which the Constitution leaves to the states. And we don't intend to push aside the Constitution and say we're going to have a federal voting system. So hopefully other states can learn from Utah. And we'll be able to provide some money, I believe, through the next relief package to get funding to states, particularly those that need it.
A sort of follow-up to an earlier question on this topic is just from your perspective, Senator Romney, why does the president say the things that he says about mail-in voting, including that, you know, Democrats are trying to rig the election and that there's widespread voter fraud when there isn't? sowing distrust again in the voting system in each state. Political strategy or what's going on there?
You know, I have long since given up on trying to understand why the president does all the things he does. So I can't give you an answer to that other than to say that in many cases, what the president does, I agree with. Many of the policies he's put in place, I think, are good for Utah, good for the country. There's some I disagree with. And particularly if there are things which are divisive or which appeal to racism, things which tear down some of the institutions of democracy, those things are of great concern to me. But understanding why the president does what he does, I'll let other people try and figure that out. It's not something I'm a professional at.
Okay. I just with the post office and mail-in voting for just a moment longer, the president and his appointees have been taking cost-cutting steps, and those are seen as undercutting the post office and making it slower. In particular, they've stopped paying overtime to mail clerks and carriers. There's a sort of fear out there that the post office is being undermined intentionally in advance of the election. Do you think that's happening?
You know, I don't have any insight other than that which the general public would have as to what the intent is for the president's policies with regards to the post office. I happen to believe that for an economy to work effectively, you need to have a mail system that works effectively. I mean, early on in our country's history, they had the Pony Express, for Pete's sakes, as a way to get communication. And hopefully we're not going back in that direction. We need to have mail that's reliable and that's as rapid as possible. I recognize that there's excessive cost in the postal system, but we have to have an effective postal system for our economy to work as it needs to.
Well, you sound like Ben Franklin there, founder of the post office. just before we wrap up, well, actually, two things. I said in conversations with your communications staff that we would talk about your proposed Trust Act, which aims to create a plan to shore up the trust funds for Medicare and Social Security, while also trying to get a handle on the national debt. So let me just apologize for not following through with that, because I don't think we'll have the time to open up that topic. I will point people to coverage in other local media of the Trust Act. But the reason I want to skip it is because I'd like to end this conversation by asking about the choice ahead of us in November. And the big news yesterday was that the Democratic nominee Joe Biden has chosen Senator Kamala Harris to be his running mate. Senator, I don't think people need reminding that you voted to convict incumbent President Trump on the abuse of power impeachment charge back in February, saying that what the president did was grievously wrong and that you would vote your conscience, partisan repercussions notwithstanding, because that was what your oath of office required. And so the question, you know, pretty simply here is, are you supporting anyone for president? And then as a follow-up, I might ask you what the Republican Party needs to do in the post-Trump era, which, of course, assumes that there is such a thing. But, you know, first up, who, if anyone, will you support for the highest office in the land, Senator Romney?
Well, I haven't indicated support for any individual at this stage, but I think it's pretty plain to people that given the fact that I did vote to remove the president from office, that I will not be voting for the president's reelection. With regards to where the Republican Party goes when President Trump is no longer president, and that will occur either in a few months or in a few years. But at that stage, I believe our party has been changed from the party as I recognized it when I was our nominee back in 2012. There will be a lot of new faces that come forward and will pull the party in one direction or another. It tends to follow the personality of the individual who is our nominee. And there'll be people like Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz. And my guess is you'll also see Tom Cotton and Josh Hawley, Nikki Haley. I mean, there are a number of individuals who could become our nominee. Each has a different political orientation. And that's kind of where the party will go. But I do believe that unless our party reaches out in a far more effective way to minorities, to women, to young people, to people of Hispanic descent. I mean, unless we do a better job there, I think we become a minority party for a long, long time.
Do you think some people will see that as being, you know, quote unquote, disloyal to the party? And, you know, party politics sometimes seem to get in the way of governing the country. I guess I'm wondering if you can wrap up with your perspective on that.
Well, my loyalty, of course, is to the oath of office, which I've taken, and the pledge I have to our country. And I do believe that the policies of conservatism and of my party are the best to encourage a better life for the American people. If I didn't believe that, I wouldn't be a Republican. That doesn't mean that I agree with everything that is said by the leader of my party. I agree with many of the things the president says. I disagree with some others. I presume that's the case for anybody in any political party. They agree with some, but not all. And I believe that you'll see post-President Trump that the party will change course in some way, depending upon the person who's chosen as our nominee. I think that's a natural process. There's no question President Trump was a bigger departure from our party's history and tradition than we had seen with prior nominees. But how big a departure we have next time around is anyone's guess.
Okay. Well, Senator Mitt Romney, thank you very much for the privilege of your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Roger. Good to be with you.
Senator Romney is back home in Utah for various meetings and events this week. I spoke with him on Wednesday morning. Before we wrap up today, we're going to follow up on a topic that we addressed last week. On that episode of In the Hive, we spoke with Salt Lake City Mayor Aaron Mendenhall about police reform measures, but began the show with a question about charges for some protesters involved in a demonstration in front of the Salt Lake County District Attorney's Office. Mayor Mendenhall was one of a number of commentators who thought that the charges brought were excessive. For the episode, I also spoke with one of the protesters facing first-degree felony criminal mischief charges that includes a gang enhancement, which theoretically means she's facing up to life in prison, Madalena McNeil. At the end of the show, I mentioned that I'd get a response from District Attorney Sim Gill, who brought those charges. I got Gill on a Zoom call yesterday. You've received a fair amount of criticism for the charges brought against a number of protesters, in particular the felony criminal mischief charge and rioting charges with a gang enhancement. Salt Lake City's Mayor Aaron Mendenhall, for example, various newspaper columnists, advocates for protest, they say that these charges are excessive. And that, for instance, in the specific case of Madalena McNeil, she's facing life in prison for, quote-unquote, buying paint and for yelling at officers and shifting her weight. In the wake of all of this criticism, have you rethought those charges at all?
Well, first of all, two things. One, our goal was always to make sure that this was going to be prosecuted outside, and it is. We announced today former Judge Dane Nolan, who is going to be working as an independent counsel. And so we knew they were going to be going out there. But the problem and challenge for us was trying to figure out how quickly we could get somebody on board. And we were involved in that process. The screening unit, which was working with on all these issues related to all the different protests and different kinds of thing, they have been screening these cases using the same methodology. And we went ahead, made a decision to go ahead and charge as a placeholder while we could get a conflict counsel in place. And so they used the exact same methodology as they did with about 23 or 26 other cases that they had filed that arose from these series of incidents. They were consistent with in the way that we've approached filing of our charges. We've always taken the approach. These are allegations and charges actually just present what is the descriptive allegations of the landscape that is presented based on the evidence and allegations that are made. There's a presumption of innocence that applies here, and we treat everybody equally the same at the beginning of that. So we don't care what your political affiliation is, where you, what your wealth status is. Everybody is charged the same. But post-charging, historically, the way we approach is then we look individually at each conduct, each person, and then we fashion out a disposition for them that is relevant to them in that sense. But let me be very clear, what I know in general, what my team has told me in general about some of the histories of the people, unless they have some really long, extensive criminal history that we're not aware of, there's nobody who's going to be going to prison on this. That was just a charging allegation at the beginning.
How much leeway? I mean, you described the consistency there. I'm wondering, you know, especially when it comes to something like the gang enhancement, which we described on last week's show. Do you always have to use it in those instances in which, you know, two or more people are involved?
So, yeah. So the thing is, given this, the context in which the team had already reviewed that, they applied that sort of uniform sort of approach in that in there. So if we had altered in one way or another, then the criticism would have been, well, you know, Sim, you're a Democrat and these folks are sort of progressives who are raising this issue, and you undercharge them. And so my point simply is the screening team that had been working on these 30 odd some cases used the same process, same procedure. And what it was when law enforcement comes up, they say, here are the charges we're requesting. We look to see. And sometimes they don't have a factual basis or an evidentiary basis, so we don't do them. But generally, our approach has been, if it elementally fits what's presented and there's support, we will articulate them that way. And then, think of it this way. One of the policy decisions that I made was, is that one of the concerns that I have is about, for example, institutional and implicit bias. Now, here's a thought experiment. If I have 10 attorneys who screen 1,000 cases over, let's say, a period of time, if they exercise their discretion, then over a period of time, I will have introduced institutional bias based on whatever their biases might be. So what we've said is, instead of differently treating everybody at the front end, we're going to treat them all the same, because that's the point where we're going to say, regardless of what your background, you're going to be treated the same. Now, on the disposition, treating everybody the same may actually give you an unjust outcome, because if I have a rich person and a poor person, and I say it's the same charge, everybody gets a flat $5,000 fine, then it would be unfair to the poor person. So then that's when we look to see at individual cases, their conditions, and then we tailor fit the disposition, because that's really where justice lies.
Can I ask, because we're low on time here,
sure.
You announced that Judge Dolan will serve as independent counsel, the conflict counsel, and so you won't be in charge of this anymore. Could he make a sort of different determination?
Absolutely. Okay. He has the complete authority to do whatever he wishes and is appropriate, right? And the other remaining cases that our office is prosecuting, we are going to do exactly that as well, right? So I don't know what Judge Nolan's going to do. That's why he's conflict counsel. He can dispose of them in any way he wants to do it, because I trust him to do that as independent counsel.
I'm wondering how you feel about just the level of criticism. I mean, I've seen T-shirts with your image on it, and a lot of criticism, especially from the protest community, about, you know, Sim Gill having blood on his hands for not holding officers accountable. How are you sort of personally dealing with that criticism?
No, you and I've talked before. I accept it as part of the job description. Our job is to go out and try to do the right thing the best way that we can, and without favor or bias to the left or to the right. And it's the application of the law. And I've always said that when you're an elected person, you should be subjected to criticism, scrutiny, and that includes me. I may not always get everything right, but our objective as an institution is to do our very best. And that means that our community of citizens has every right to criticize, be critical of, ask questions. And our job is to try to answer them the best as we can. So to me, I don't take it personally. I look at it as a part of the job, and I expect it from our community of citizens to be invested and involved. And if they are, then this is exactly what they should be doing.
Again, that's Salt Lake County District Attorney Sim Gill, and that is all the time we have for on the show today. You've been listening to In the Hive here on KCPW, a listener-supported, entirely independent public radio resource. Our theme music is by Andrew Shaw. I'm Roger McDonough. Please join us again next week.